books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show made in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and today we have a listen back to the first sounds ever recorded and trace a line from there to the 90th anniversary of RNIB Talking Books. On today's special show, we'll look back not only at the history of talking books, but the history of the recorded spoken word as a whole, and how RNIB Talking Books have not only kept up with technology, but in many cases, they were the pioneers. So, coming up today, we'll hear the first sounds ever recorded. We'll follow the invention of the phonograph and the gramophone, and hear about the format war between cylinders and discs. We'll hear about studio bombings and the sinking of a ship that was carrying vital gramophone needles. We'll listen to some of the first ever talking books and hear about the narrators and engineers that recorded them and the way they were listened to. On disc, tape, CD, USB stick, downloads, or by a simple voice command. All coming up on today's Read On. In November 1935, the Sound Recording Committee sent out the first ever talking book machine and long playing record. Our story today, however, goes back to 1860. The first sound ever recorded was never actually meant to be played back. Patrick Feaster from firstsounds.org joins us to explain more. But first, let's have a listen to Au Clair de la Lune.
What you've just heard was a series of sounds recovered from a sheet of paper covered in soot with a waveform scratched into it on April 9th, 1860. That date is actually written on the document itself. Played back using technology developed at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. And when we initially played it back, we believed that it was the voice of a young girl, possibly the inventor's daughter.
But you've since discovered that that may have been the wrong speed.
We discovered that it almost certainly was the wrong speed. After playing back another recording, this time not of singing, but of speech. And at this time, we heard a recording that was clearly spoken much too quickly when played back at that same speed. It was much more apparent that we were playing it too fast. And at this point, we recognized that, in fact, we were listening not to the voice of a young girl, but in all likelihood to the voice of the inventor himself. Well, Edouard Léon Scott de Martinville invented sound recording in the sense that we understand today. What he did not do was invent playback. His phonautograph was designed to record sound using really the same logic found in Edison's later phonograph, with a few rather minor technical differences. Sound passing through the air entered into a funnel, which he built with a membrane attached to the end of it. The idea was that this would work as an artificial ear. Once sound hit the membrane at the end of this funnel, it would cause a little stylus to wiggle back and forth and scratch a line on a sheet of paper, which is really identical in principle to the groove on a later gramophone disc. His idea was not that people would then play these recordings back. His idea was instead that he would fix the voice on sheets of paper so that people could look at these inscriptions and maybe eventually learn to imagine in their mind's ear what the original sound had been. Although, theoretically, they could have been printed as raised lines on sheets of paper and read by touch.
What gave you the idea to actually decide to play them back?
The idea of playing these recordings back goes back a number of years. People have recognized for a long time that these were, for all practical purposes, sound recordings that could be played back, even though they hadn't been. However, First Sounds was the first group to actually play back one of Scott's phonautograms, thanks in large part to the development of this technology by Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, which was originally designed and is still being used to play back early sound recordings in formats such as wax cylinders, which are very fragile. The advantage is that this uses a laser or light to read the recordings without actually touching them. So there's much less risk of damage from playing them with a stylus. And also there are some other advantages in terms of getting the best signal out. So really it was the availability of this technology plus our interest in hearing them that came together to make this a reality.
We'll hear more from Patrick Feaster in a moment. That last piece of audio was a recording of the opening lines from Tasso's Aminta, which, although undated, appears to have been made slightly later than Au Clair de la Lune. But as it's spoken and not sung, it is, at the moment, the earliest audible record of recognisable human speech. Well, recognisable enough to follow if you already know the words. If you want more information and to read those words, you can head to www.firstsounds.org.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
Our story now moves forward to 1868 and the founding of what we now know as RNIB. Thomas Rhodes Armitage was born in Sussex in 1824. He became a successful doctor, but had to retire in his mid-30s because of failing eyesight, around the time that Edward Leon Scott de Martinville was making his historic recordings. Dr. Armitage decided to devote his energy to improving the terrible conditions that existed for blind people. At that time, few people with impaired vision had any formal education, and most had to beg in the streets or rely on their relatives for food and shelter. Although a wealthy man himself, Dr. Armitage recognised that money alone didn't answer long-term problems, particularly with regard to independence. The solution lay in enabling blind people to gain both self-respect and new opportunities through education, training and employment. Dr. Armitage knew that the only way that people with sight problems could achieve these things was if they could learn to read and write for themselves. In 1868, a meeting in Dr. Armitage's house in London led to the formation of an organisation known as the British and Foreign Society for improving embossed literature for the blind. This new organisation set about investigating all the known forms of embossed writing, and after 2 years of thorough research, Dr. Armitage and his colleagues concluded that Braille was the most effective form of tactile writing available. Braille's major advantage over other tactile systems was that in addition to being able to read it, blind people could also write it for themselves. By the 1870s, the society was now simply called the British and Foreign Blind Association, and the first Braille plates and writing frames were being produced, with 1871 seeing the publication of the key to the Braille alphabet. However, it would be another 50 years or so before RNIB started research into making books that talked. So in the meantime, we need to travel to Menlo Park in New Jersey and the workshop of one Thomas Alva Edison. The Yankeeana Rag, performed by the American Symphony Orchestra, and it was released on wax cylinder by Edison's National Phonographic Company. But we're getting a little ahead of ourselves, because in 1877, Thomas Alva Edison was working on two inventions, the telegraph and the telephone, and looking for a way to transcribe telegraphic messages through indentations on paper tape. Gramophone and phonograph expert Howard Hope tells us how Edison became so adept at operating the telegraph.
The famous story is that as part of the young Edison's accidental education is that working by the shunting yards in Milan, Ohio, the young Edison saw a baby walking free in the shunting yard. Edison saw the child and picked it up supposedly before it would have been
crushed between two wagons or certainly being caught up in the shunting. The father of the baby, in gratitude, taught Edison how to be a telegraph operator in the old-fashioned Morse key type tapping sending. Edison ended up so able that he won regional and statewide contests for the speed at which he could operate the Morse key source for transmission. And one thing that he noticed is that when the punched tapes were running through the machines at speed, he noticed the pitch rise and fall as the number of holes in the punch tape shot through the machine. He realised that what he was listening to was a sort of visually readable expression of the frequencies, the notes that were being generated. And that was the right at the heart of his realisation of what might be done.
Edison, though, decided he wanted to be an inventor instead of a telegraph operator. He settled in Boston, borrowed money from private investors, and shared a workshop with other inventors and scientists. His first official invention was the electric voting machine. He received the first of his 1,093 patents for it, and although it worked well, no one wanted to vote electronically. As a result, he developed a new business philosophy to create only what people knew they needed.
The first invention with which he made money was the duplex telegraph. The value of that was that in the early days, you could only send one message down a telephone line at a time. And therefore, telephone line time was extremely valuable. And therefore, the speed at which operators could send messages down telegraph lines, the faster the operator could work, the more messages that could be sent, pretty obviously. Edison patented a method whereby multiple messages could be sent without confusing each other down the same line. And that was an incredibly valuable patent at the time, and the sale of that invention is what basically set him up for his young life.
Edison's father built a research lab for him in New Jersey. The Menlo Park shop was the first idea factory of its kind in the world. It housed a laboratory, a machine shop, a carpentry shop, an office and a library, and Edison hired many assistants with many specialities from all over the world, and it was one of these people who actually made the first tin foil phonograph.
To give Edison his due, he had conceived the whole invention in his head prior to the making of the tin foil phonograph, and quite romantically, Edison already had a workshop in which things that he had conceived were made by members of a tight-knit and very skillful team of chemists and engineers he had around him. And Edison had a system of working that was delightful. He made a drawing of what he would like to see made. He then posted it on a notice board within this building in which he was working, which was his own building. And he wrote on the board the value of the job to him. So he put up a job and he put this job $5 on another job $25. And it fell to a Swiss-trained engineer called John Cruzy. And John Cruzy it was who took down, unpinned from the board, the job which Edison had put up, which was to build the tinfoil phonograph. And Cruzy accepted whatever it was, $15, $20, because if you took on a job, you then basically kept the card and traded it for the money at the end of the week. And he built the Edison tinfoil phonograph to Edison's specification. And Edison said himself, I was never more surprised in all my life when it worked first time.
Mary had a little lamb, its fleece was white as snow, and everywhere that Mary went, the lamb was sure to go.
That's romantic now, really, because he may have said it later on in life, but a tinfoil recording lasts at most for about five plays before the attrition of the needle on the tinfoil just obliterates what message was there. It's very, very faintly on it, and can only be heard very, very faintly. And it certainly, the sound that it makes can't be heard, more than a few yards from the machine, however well recorded it is.
Astonished at the wonderful power you have developed, and terrified at the thought that so much hideous bad music may be put on record forever.
That's Arthur Sullivan of Gilbert and Sullivan recording a message for Thomas Edison and saying that he's terrified of the thought that so much hideous and bad music may be put on record forever. Now, back in the day, there was no such thing as an audio enhancer. So, as with a lot of the very early recordings on today's show, let's hear what it sounds like if we sprinkle some modern magic on it.
I can only say that I am astonished and somewhat terrified at the result of this evening's experiment. Astonished at the wonderful power you have developed, and terrified at the thought that so much hideous bad music may be put on record forever. But all the same, I think it is the most wonderful thing that I have ever experienced, and I congratulate you with all my heart on this wonderful discovery. Albert Sullivan.
But the recording of music didn't interest Edison at all.
Edison was a serious-minded man. All his life, he didn't much like thespians and he didn't much like musicians. He was very much the scientist technocrat. And his original invention, he really wanted to see as an office tool. So a lot of the early development of the phonograph was in the expectation that it would be an office dictation machine. Also, quite early on, it was suggested that last wills and testaments could be left as a phonograph recording, because there would be no argument as to whose voice had said they were going to leave what to what, which is quite an interesting idea, really. And various other quite serious applications. But you have to remember that in the very early days, the technology wasn't frankly good enough, just straightforward good enough for music. It could deal with a human voice. But it's an amazing thing that after the initial excitement that people had about the phonograph, it was exhibited everywhere as a novelty and then put back on the shelf again because nobody could think of a use for the invention. And that, looking back, seems preposterous. The invention sat around for 11 years doing nothing. And looking back, we can hardly conceive of how that could have been.
In June 1878, in the North American Review, Edison offered a list of possible uses for the phonograph. They were letter writing and all kinds of dictation without the aid of a stenographer, the teaching of elocution, the family record, and the last words of dying persons. He also thought the technology could be used in music boxes, toys, and in clocks. This was a vision shared by inventor Frank Lambert, who actually built an experimental talking clock. He realised that tinfoil would not provide a lasting record, so he chose to experiment with a cylinder made of lead. As a result, his early sound recording experiments can still be heard today. And that recording of Frank Lampard calling out the hours is listed in the Guinness Book of World Records as the world's oldest playable phonograph recording. Edison, though, also thought that the phonograph could be used as a sort of primitive answering machine for the telephone. He writes, "So as to make that instrument an auxiliary in the transmission of permanent and invaluable records, instead of being the recipient of momentary and fleeting communication. But second on this list is phonographic books, which will speak to blind people without effort on their part." Let's hear once again from Patrick Feaster from firstsounds.org.
Edison was very interested from the beginning in using his phonograph as a means of making books available to the blind. He thought that there would be a number of advantages to this. First of all, you could have very famous elocutionists recite books, people who would ordinarily be very expensive to have read to you in person. But they could read a book through once, make a tinfoil sheet of their voice, and then have this duplicated in thousands of copies that could be sent out. Moreover, you could stop it when you wanted to. You could go back and listen to a section again. It was supposed to have a lot of advantages. You could even change the playback speed if you wanted to have it read to you quickly or slowly. Although there was this idea that people would create speaking books, talking books, at a very early date, it wasn't practical yet because the recording media available at first would not allow you to record a whole book at once. You were limited to perhaps 2, 3, 4 minutes. And so you did get a number of early sound recordings that included excerpts from books, often read by professional elocutionists, but certainly nothing the length of a full talking book.
Thank you. By this point in the story, the novelty of the phonograph has worn off. No one knows what to do with the machine, and Edison himself is concentrating instead on inventing the incandescent light bulb. In this void, others moved forward to improve on the design. In 1880, Alexander Graham Bell won the Volta Prize of $10,000 from the French government for his invention of the telephone. He approached Edison with a view to collaborating on a new phonograph.
I've got this money. I know a certain amount about acoustics and electric. You invented the phonograph, which hasn't been exploited for 11 years. Let's put our heads together and really do something about this phonograph.
Howard Hope from gramophonesuk.com.
And Edison basically flew into a jealous fit. His favourite invention, nobody else was going to get their hands on it, and this, that and the other. So Bell had his own go and developed his own machine, which, to cock a snook at Edison, he jokingly called the graphophone, as opposed to the phonograph. Phonograph, of course, simply being a pig Greek word meaning sound writer. Now, the trouble with all inventions like this, like the invention of the sewing machine, was that although Bell had considerably improved Edison's patent, there were areas in which he had infringed them, and off they went to court over this. Now, in the case of the sewing machine, Elias Howe and Isaac Singer each had half of the answer to the perfect sewing machine, and very sensibly they shook hands and they stayed friends and made an awful lot of money. Edison, however, was an autocrat. He didn't want Bell in there, and so all they did was battle away with each other in the courts, year in, year out, for many years, trying to get the lion's share of the money that was to come out of this invention, which by now was becoming a worldwide phenomenon.
I am the Edison phonograph, created by the great wizard of the New World to delight those who would have melody or be amused. I can sing you tender songs of love. I can give you merry tales and joyous laughter. I can transport you to the realms of music. I can cause you to join in the rhythmic dance.
The technology was improved and refined over the next few years, and commercial phonographs for home use were now becoming a viable, if expensive, option. To publicise the technology, many early sound recordists captured some extraordinary audio. Here's Florence Nightingale blessing her dear old comrades from Balaclava, recorded on Edison paraffin wax cylinder on July the 30th, 1890.
Carlos, my dear old comrades of Balaclava, Florence Nightingale. God bless my dear old comrade of Balaclava, Lawrence Nightingale.
Also in 1890, an Edison recording agent captured Alfred Lord Tennyson reading his poem, The Charge of the Light Brigade. The length of the wax cylinder at the time was perfect for short poetry, but as we'll hear about later on, you only get one take when recording to wax. Here's Robert Browning for getting the words to his poem, How They Brought the Good News from Ghent to X. Much of it is very indistinct, but you can hear him saying sorry because he can't remember his own verses. All of these recordings so far are on various types of cylinder, but at this point in the story, we're joined by Emil Berliner, who had invented a simpler way to record audio to disc in 1888, and successfully marketed his technology to toy companies.
A lot of people feel that cylinders came first, and then discs came afterwards, and it comes as quite a big surprise to a number of people to find out that in fact, if you went to central London in 1888, you could have gone into a toy shop on Oxford Street to Parkins and Gotto, and you could have bought a working gramophone with a small repertoire of admittedly children's disc before you could have walked into a shop in England anywhere and bought a cylinder phonograph and some cylinders. So in fact, the gramophone was exploited
before the phonograph.
Berliner was David to Edison's Goliath, and although the gramophone was the better technology, it took a long time for the disc to win the format war over the cylinder, and in the end it was down to purely practical reasons.
You can make gramophone records very quickly and easily, and you can store them very easily, whereas cylinder phonograph records made of brittle paraffin wax are extremely cumbersome to make. Once you've made them, they're brittle to transport, and once you've got them to your home, they're not the easiest things on earth to store. So really, if Exxon hadn't had a vast amount of money to start with, or if they've started from an even playing field, Edison's invention would hardly risen to the commercial heights that it did, because frankly, Berliner won the system eventually on the grounds that basically the gramophone was always going to have been the better invention when it came to providing people with a repertoire and records that they could transport and store.
Length of recordings was also an issue, with cylinders lasting at the most for around 4 minutes. Discs could last up to 7 minutes, a length that doubled when it was realised that grooves could be cut into both sides. Columbia, one of Edison's chief competitors, abandoned the cylinder market in 1912, and the United States Phonograph Company ceased production of its US Everlasting cylinders in 1913. Later in 1913, Edison conceded to this reality when he announced that he was beginning to manufacture an Edison disc phonograph. So by 1914, the disc gramophone as we know it was the preferred format for listening to audio, and with the manipulation of turntable speeds, more and more audio could fit onto a disc. Also in 1914 in the UK, the British and Foreign Blind Association became the National Institute for the Blind. The royal part wouldn't be added until 1953. But overseas, trouble was brewing that would mean the National Institute for the Blind would be caring for thousands of more blind and partially sighted people within the next 4 years. The outbreak of World War I. Many of the troops returning to the UK during and after the war were completely blinded, and many more had some sort of sight problem. The popular reason given for this is because of the use of mustard and chlorine gas, but just as many injuries were sustained by bullets and by shell fragments. Whatever the reason, the returning troops with sight problem found Braille difficult to learn, and by 1920, the National Institute for the Blind began testing different formats and methods of making talking books. In America, the American Foundation for the Blind was dealing with the same situation, and both organisations started testing the new long-playing gramophone record as a possible format. In 1931, the American Congress started a program called the Books for the Adult Blind Project, with the first talking books produced in 1932. In the UK in 1934, the National Institute for the Blind joins forces with St Dunstan's, a charity dedicated to caring for soldiers blinded in war, and form a sound recording committee. Chairman of the committee is Sir Ian Fraser, who himself was blinded by a German bullet at the Battle of the Somme, and along with being chairman of St Dunstan's, he's also a British politician and a governor of the BBC. He set up an experimental studio in his garden to continue researching and improving different sound recording methods, and eventually settled on a method of recording to wax disc. Ian Turner tells us more about the recording process.
Recording on wax discs means that you have to have a one take, basically. If you make a mistake during that recording, the whole disc is just wiped clean. So you have these narrators we had then had to record for about 25 minutes without making a mistake, and they were really adept at covering over mistakes, apparently. I remember one of our narrators called Andrew Timothy. He used to talk to us about recording on wax discs, and he was very clear about what he has to do. If he made a mistake, he didn't actually make a mistake, he just sort of covered it over and carried on recording. And one of his favourite things he used to say is that the important thing, if you say a word that you've never heard of before, say it with such conviction that people who have been saying it correctly for the last 20 years are now wondering whether they are saying it correctly.
Quickly and with confidence. Yeah.
Absolutely.
What is on that wax is only and exactly what that man truly was able to do. And this is a game where a lot of people accord some of these early artists with tremendous honour, because there's not so many people can do it these days.
Howard Hope from gramophonesuk.com.
EMI made a 78 record to celebrate their history, and they invited Roberto Alagna to come to Abbey Road Studios and make an Opera 78. And somebody in the Gramophone Society revamped a cutting lathe, and Alagna, who is a lovely chap, turned up to do it. A big warmed-up wax disc was put on. The pianist started to play. Alagna drew breath. And he sung a few bars, and then, regretting the way he'd cut into something, he stopped and shook his hand the way you do it at a rehearsal. And the person at the recording machine said, OK, we'll do it again in about 20 minutes. I've got to take this off. I've got to clean all the wax off the machine. We've got to get another disc out and set it up. We've got to put the needle in the first groove. And then Alagna suddenly realised that these recordings of Caruso, Melba and Patti were all absolutely, once through, you know, this is your charm. Those great artists would have gone into a studio and they'd have had half a dozen goes at any one aria, and then they'd have chosen their favourite one. But even the best one would be with the fewest faults, because there was no chance to pick up anything that went wrong. And I say this is part of the delight of the whole subject.
So by 1935, even with the limitations of recording to wax, the Sound Recording Committee has five complete books. And on the 7th of November 1935, the Sound Recording Committee sends out the first talking book machines and records. The records themselves were made of shellac, a material that was not without its problems. Let's hear once again from Ian Turner.
A shellac is like a very thick plastic, and you know, if you drop them, they just shattered, basically. The average length book, let's say 10, 12 hours, so you're talking 10, 15 discs, perhaps. They were stored in very durable boxes with large straps going around them. And those durable boxes held these discs and were sent out by post in the same sort of way as we do now, of course.
The service truly was one of a kind. It even pioneered the long-playing record as we know it today.
Shellac discs were very new in terms of mass producing, and people like Decca and EMI were coming to R&IB to find out how we produced the books on our discs and how we mass produced them. We were telling their engineers how we did it so they could develop it even further.
The talking book service grew at an incredible rate. Two types of machine were issued, as not all talking book listeners had electricity, so both electrical and mechanical versions were available. By the end of 1935, there were 40 titles in the library, one of which was Thackeray's Henry Esmond. Because of RNIB's extensive re-archiving work, this title still exists, so I gave a copy to our regular Vida Harding to have a listen.
Henry Esmond by William Makepeace Thackeray. It's read by Eric Gillett. It is told in 42 chapters and a preface. My dear and honoured father, Colonel Henry Esmond, whose history written by himself is contained in the accompanying volume, came to Virginia in the year 1718, built his house of Castlewood, and here permanently settled.
What I would say is that it felt very much as if it was recorded at the time. If you watch films, I'm a particular fan of something like Brief Encounter, a really iconic film with Trevor Howard and Celia Johnson, and they talk, if you remember, anyone who knows the film, in that rather clipped, very, very English way. And I guess the reading by Eric Gillis in this particular recording is similar. So yes, to that extent, it did sound of its time. Having said that, it is on digital Daisy CD, which, surprise, surprise, they didn't have in 1935. And it's interesting that when I was listening to the start of the recording, it talks about money having been given to remaster or finesse it. So it's not got crackles and it doesn't sound to that extent a dated recording, but the actual voice is very much that 1930s very, very English delivery.
The Murder of Roger Ackroyd by Agatha Christie. Read by Laidman Brown. Chapter 1. Dr. Shepherd at the breakfast table.
Don't forget that this was one of the early recordings. Another one was an Agatha Christie. And it shows, actually, so many titles now recorded, that even back in those early days, you know, people were keen to get a versatility, a diversity of recordings to suit every taste. So, yeah, today we've talked about, you know, a 19th century novel, which is not necessarily a household name, but from a famous author of that time. But it's important to remember that there were lots of other sort of recordings being done at the same time, as there are to this day.
Talking Books receive an enthusiastic reaction from blind and partially sighted people. An article in The Times in 1936 quotes a blind ex-soldier's reaction. The person who thought of the Talking Book ought to have a monument three times the size of Nelson's. This is how I enjoy the Talking Book. Every night about 10 o'clock, I make the fire up, draw my armchair near, then I switch on the Talking Book. Don't you think this is real luxury?
At last, these people who have just come back from the war could actually start reading, and they could certainly see a way forward, and were very encouraged by what they were doing. At last, blind and partially sighted people could now read.
By 1937, the first permanent recording studio was built, and by September of that year, 966 machines and 2,639 books have been sent out to library users. Research also continues, focusing on alternatives to shellac. The material, while commercially popular, is very brittle, and many talking books are being damaged or broken in the post. Attention is also turned to the gramophone players themselves, solving the problem of users accidentally scratching the records by putting the needle down incorrectly. An automatic arm placer was invented and later introduced. The Sound Recording Committee in the UK has worked closely from the early days with the American Foundation for the Blind, who have also been producing talking books. Both organisations want to avoid duplication of books, to be able to exchange books and to benefit from each other's work and research. This piece of audio from 1939 features an AFB library member receiving his list of new books.
Very well, thank you, Bill. Haven't got very much for you this morning, Mr. Walters. Just a little pamphlet, no letters.
Oh, I suppose it's an advertisement.
Well, let's see. It's got the name printed on it. Talking Book Topics.
Oh, Topics. Oh, that's fine. I've been looking forward to that.
Well, the first person I've met that looks forward to advertisements, Mr. Walters.
Oh, but this isn't an advertisement. This is a little booklet that tells me about new talking books. I'm about out of reading matter, so it'll come in handy.
You've told me about that machine of yours. Must be great company for you.
It certainly is.
With thanks to the American Federation for the Blind for that audio, which was recorded in 1939. 1939 also sees the outbreak of World War II, and in 1940, talking books are dealt a severe blow. The recording studio and production unit are bombed during the Blitz. A temporary studio is set up, and it suffers the same fate some months later.
But the service kept going, and one recording machine fortunately survived both bombs, and so recording began once again in about August 1941.
During the war, the AFB sends a gift of 500,000 gramophone needles to the Sound Recording Committee.
And of course, needles became blunt. If you don't have needles to play these gramophone records, you just couldn't hear them, basically. So the blunter the needles became, the worse the sound became. So we needed new needles to keep the thing going.
However, before the needles can be delivered, they are destroyed by enemy action in the docks in England. The committee is devastated until news comes through that the manufacturers in America will repeat the order. In 1945, the war ends, and life at the National Institute for the Blind returns to some semblance of normality. In America, the AFB are very aware that blind societies and organisations in Europe still need their help. This letter by Robert B. Irwin of AFB is read by Alexander Scorby.
It's difficult for us, living in a country which experienced practically no physical damage from combat activities, to realise what war has done to the blind people and to agencies for the blind in Europe. Where active fighting was carried on, many schools for the blind were completely demolished. In other cases, the buildings were damaged by gunfire. Braille slates and other metals were confiscated to make munitions. Braille books were used for fuel. A number of the workshops for the blind were so badly damaged that nothing remains but unheated cellars with temporary roofs in which sightless workmen are trying to earn a little toward their support. In several countries, the Braille printing plants were so completely demolished that there's not a vestige of the old machinery in existence.
That audio was from 75 years of AFB and Talking Books, copyright American Foundation for the Blind. If you want to know more, you can contact www.afb.org/talkingbooks.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
From 1948 to 1958, experiments were carried out on new Talking Books technology.
Well, magnetic tape was being seen as the next revolution, if you like, of audio recording. And we realised that discs were going to phase out and perhaps, although very good, audio tape was going to be much better.
There were limited field trials of the Mark I Talking Book Player, the first tape talking book. This is a large steel cassette that measured 10 inches by 6 inches by 1.5 inches, but it had 18 hours of recorded material on its 22 tracks.
Leading technology again, it was a large steel cassette, you've just given the dimensions, and inside that cassette were two reels of tape, and it was a continuous loop, if you like. It went from one reel to the other and just carried on going on and on going on. At the front of that cassette, there was a big hole about an inch wide, and in that there was this large metal spring that people had to push their fingers into to change tracks, something that you'd never be allowed to do nowadays because it's very sharp and quite dangerous.
That's the end of track one. At the end of this announcement, move the control lever to off, remove the cassette, turn it over and replace it in the machine, then press the track change button once. Do this now.
By 1960, the new Mark I Talking Book Player was issued. The cassettes were so big and heavy that the postman had to deliver them separately to the normal mail. But even so, this is a huge leap forward for RNIB. So big, it made the news.
Lord Fraser explained the operation of the tape recording magazine now being adopted by the library of the Royal National Institute for the Blind, of which Mr. Godfrey Robinson, on the left, is chairman. The all-enclosed cassette, used on the playback equipment many blind people have, makes up the world's best talking book machine. Franklin Engelman and others in radio and the theatre have their readings recorded for the blind. Pickwick Papers here.
How should I know, retorted Mr. Weller. I thought they looked very like it. Yeah, what are they, then? Clerks, replied Sam. What do they all eat in ham sandwiches for? Inquired his father. Because it's in their duty, I suppose, replied Sam. It's a part of the system. They're always a-doing it here all day long.
The Talking Book Library near Wembley has more than 6,500 members. Most of them send their requests by post. Till recently, the recordings have been on long-playing disc. Many were needed for a whole book. Multi-track tape gets it all in a single cassette. With so many members, the library dispatch department is kept busy. In houses all over the country, the arrival of the cassettes is, for many sightless persons, the high spot of the week. They quickly get the hang of operating the machine. Pickwick, read aloud, has given pleasure to millions for more than a century. Now, readings from the whole field of literature are being brought to the blind.
With thanks to British Pathé. That clip is available at britishpathé.com. The tape player, the Mark I, was used until 1967, when field trials started for the new Mark IV player.
Mark II never actually materialised. Mark II and III were just developments between the ones we eventually issued to the Mark IV. The Mark IV was the one we used for a long, long time, from about 1965 right up to 2002, where we, you know, introduced a new system.
The new player uses smaller cassettes, and adapter plates were made for the Mark I players, which allows the new cassettes to be played on the old machine. In 1968, RNIB celebrated its 100th birthday. And 1 year later, membership of the RNIB library reached 25,000 listeners, with 13,000 having the new Mark IV system. The studios themselves needed an update, and in 1977 they switched location and switched recording equipment.
In those days, we used to record on one-inch tape, directly onto one-inch tape, and that one-inch tape was sent to the production unit in Alberton, where they made the cassettes. But then we moved to just up the road from Great Portland Street, original studios, and we moved about 50 yards up the road to new studios, and we recorded on quarter-inch tape.
The new studios were quite unusual, in that one engineer was looking after two simultaneous recordings.
Very odd, but we had, as we have now, extremely good narrators, and what we looked at is a way of increasing production and at the same time maintain quality. The engineer looked after two narrators at the same time, one reader reading one book, another reader reading another book. And the engineer used to jump from reader to reader, listen to what they were saying, making sure they're reading things correctly. The reader never knew who we were listening to, and so we could check on the quality of their reading and making sure that they were reading things properly.
Hello, I'm Ray Sawyer, and I've been reading for R&I by Baba. How's that? Does that work?
You could conceivably shoot the rapids if you were in a canoe. Can you?
The new digital Bokingtuk?
Bokingtuk, yeah. It's a new word.
It was not something he'd have...
You're a sort of, you know, genial bumbling.
What the engineer used to have to do is stop the tape, wind the tape back a little bit, listen to a place where we could slot the reader back in again, tell the reader where we wanted him to start, play the tape, and at the same time as putting a cue light on, we used to put the player into record, therefore rubbing out the mistake and recording the whole thing correctly. So what we're left with is a tape which was 2 hours long, one side of tape was 2 hours, without any mistakes whatsoever. Most speech studios would come along and edit all the books afterwards, but in the way we did it, we were able to say right at the end of the book, that's it, we haven't got any more work to do, and it was a perfect finish.
And if the tape was running out, the narrators were encouraged to maybe speed up a bit.
We looked at the tape, we looked at the book, we looked at the amount of tape we had, and I said, look, there's a chapter heading coming up in a page and a half's time. You've got 3 minutes. Can you speed up a little bit? We're not going... It wasn't quite that bad, but we did tend to try and speed up a little bit.
As early as 1982, there was talk of digitising the service, with minutes for a meeting at the time talking of the possibility of using cable TV and squirting audio down the line. But it wasn't until the late 90s that plans were set in motion to introduce a new digital service. In 2001, the studios move once again. The new site in Camden Town was equipped with state-of-the-art digital recording equipment that could be used by both blind and sighted engineers. Studio manager at the time was Douglas Keane.
We started using this system called DAISY, which means Digital Accessible Information System. What DAISY is a navigation system on CD, and I've got a DAISY machine here.
Himalaya by Michael Palin.
Now what you can do is you can then navigate through the book if you want to by just pressing buttons.
Day 3, south to Dara. Day 4, Fatajang.
It tells you exactly where you are in the book by pressing the information button, which I'm going to press now.
Info, current position. Time elapsed. 55 minutes, 45 seconds.
You can bookmark your position so that you can go back to it.
Bookmark list.
This isn't technology for its own sake. This is a much more user-friendly way of accessing the books and much more beneficial to the members of the Talking Book Service.
Bringing the Talking Book Service into the new millennium was a two-way operation, which not only meant building the new studios to record and master digitally, but also to re-archive the 12,400 Talking Books that were currently on analogue tape.
We couldn't possibly lose those. That was a huge archive. And so we worked on developing a process of transferring all of those books across to the digital system and then transferring them again into the DAISY structure. A huge task, and it also allowed us to look at what books we had, see if there was any gaps in the system, see if any books actually needed re-recording, see if any recordings were so poor that we had to re-record them again. I remember one, I won't tell you his name, but we had one gentleman who if he didn't like the way he was recording, this was before my time, I hasten to add, if he didn't like what he was recording, he used to change it to suit his own needs. Or if he didn't like one particular sentence, he used to cut that out as well. And those books we've reread, and I've got a much better version now.
But apart from the odd exception, the service has always had great narrators.
I can go back years, we've got books by Peter Cushing. Now, Peter Cushing, in those days, in the 70s, never read for commercial books. There was no such thing as commercial audiobooks in those days. And we've got several books read by Peter Cushing, Joyce Grenfell, an early Richard Baker books, Michael Aspel books, Joss Ackland, Terence Stamp, Michael Palin, obviously, he's been reading for us for a long, long time now, and some real, real old classics that are still in the library.
I moved my head to look at the cabinet behind me. When I turned again, Sherlock Holmes was standing smiling at me across my study table.
I first saw her act when I was a schoolboy towards the end of the 1914 war.
James and the Giant Peach was the very first of the 15 or 16 children's books I've written.
This is Doris Lessing, and I'm reading a chapter from my novel, The Sweetest Dream.
Hello, I'm A.S. Byatt, and I'm reading a piece called Odors, Savors, Sweet, which gave me the chance to say something I've been wanting very badly to say for a very long time.
My name is Jim Broadbent, and I'm delighted to be reading The Talking Books.
Hello, I'm Helena Bonham Carter, and I'm reading Sandy and Her Beautiful Sisters, A Modern Fairy Tale, by Antonia Fraser.
Although Daisy CDs are still available today, they are, as with many physical media formats, on the way out. James Bartlett is the RNIB Reading Services Manager, and he told me all about his job.
So I have three main areas that I'm responsible for. We have our Talking Book Library and our Braille Library, which is our collection of leisure reading material in those formats. We have RNIB Bookshare, which is digital like EPUB titles for people in education, school, college and university. And then we have RNIB Newsagent, which is where people get their newspapers, their magazines, their TV and radio guides.
And what we're concentrating on today is the library side of things. The Talking Book Service has had a very big anniversary lately.
I know, it's incredible, isn't it? 90th celebration. I mean, it's just, when you think about from where it started back in 1935 and the titles it was doing then and on those big shellac discs. And here we are 90 years later, and it's more in demand than ever. It's a fantastic service we have.
Now, some people might not know this. They may not have kept up with the current technological advances that the Talking Books Library has had. You mentioned shellac discs, which then became LPs, which then became cassettes. How can readers access their books in the library today?
So there's a variety of methods. For people who have some form of online connectivity, we have it available on Alexa. Amazon Alexa is a skill. You can get RNIB Talking Books through that. A lot of people with a smartphone or a tablet really enjoy using Dolphin's Easy Reader. That's a very smooth app to use to read our content. There are other options out there as well. And some people go direct to our reading services website to download the title to their preferred device as well. So there's all kinds of routes there to get hold of the file electronically. So you could be sat at home on a Saturday night, think, I want to read whatever latest title. Check on our library. If we've got it, start reading it pretty much straight away.
Open RNIB Talking Books.
Welcome back. To search for a book, say find followed by the title.
Find Round Ireland with a Fridge.
I found Round Ireland with a Fridge by Tony Hawkes. To read from the beginning, say start. Or choose one of the following. Table of contents or description.
Start.
Great. Enjoy your book. When you are done reading, say cancel.
This is an RNIB Talking Book. Round Ireland with a Fridge by Tony Hawkes.
Alongside that, we realise that not everybody is online in these ways, so we do still send out our titles on USB stick, and we still send them out on CD. That is reducing in number as the number of customers who want CD declines, but we do still send out CDs and USBs through Royal Mail as well to people.
Yeah, when the library started 90 years ago, you couldn't assume the user had electricity. So there were two sort of record players, one you could plug in and one that you could wind up. And the modern day equivalent of that is not assuming everyone has Wi-Fi.
Absolutely, yes.
What else can people get in there?
Well, the library has gone from strength to strength We are so grateful to the publishers who have, for the last 10 years or so, they've given us their audiobook collections. So the library has now grown. It's got over 52,000 titles available. And I'm sure many of our listeners will remember when you would have to wait some time to get the latest must-have title. And what we're able to do now is actually publish it on the same day that everybody else is reading it in the audio or the print or whatever other format. So everybody is up to speed with the latest exciting, thrilling book, whatever your tastes are, whether you know you're after the latest Richard Osman title or something different. We have such a wide range and more than enough, I think, with 52,000 titles to keep somebody fully occupied reading, you know, day in and day out.
Yeah, I've been with RNIB and in the orbit of the library for a number of years. I remember when a huge deal was made about one of the Harry Potter books coming out at the same time as its print counterpart. But now that is the norm.
It is, which is where it should be, isn't it? And I have to, you know, congratulate the team, you know, the people who've worked with the publishers, the team who onboard these files, get them available, all the way through to the people who get them out the door from our production centre. Reading is one of the best things. And to be able to read the title that everybody you know is reading and is talking about, to be up to speed and to put in your own comments and thoughts and disagree on your opinion of a title, whether you love it or loathe it, I think that's fantastic. And more of it, please.
So if anyone is interested in joining the library, where can they go?
So if people want to download our service digitally, they can go to readingservices.rnib.org.uk and there is a registration process there. If they can then link that account through to an RNIB Amazon Alexa skill, RNIB Talking Books is a skill available on there, and they can link their account, or they can use Dolphin Easy Reader and link their account through there. If you know they're not digitally connected, which you know that's fine, people aren't, then they can call our helpline on 0303 123 9999, and they can be taken through the process of being added to our USB stick or CD service, and then we will send out titles in the post to people.
You can also search for rniblibrary.com, or that helpline number once again is 0303 123 9999.
That's the end of track one. At the end of this announcement, move the control lever to off, remove the cassette, turn it over and replace it in the machine, then press the track change button once. Do this now.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.